I'm Kara Lawrence. My guest today is conductor Andrew Kohler, who is here to tell us about the next Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra concert coming up Sunday. Nice to have you here.
Good morning, Kara. Thanks as always for having me.
This program features the bronze medalist of the Stolberg International String Competition.
Yes. As your listeners have probably heard me say a lot of times, we have a long-standing relationship with the Stolberg, which makes perfect historical sense because Julius Stolberg was a music director of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony for decades, and a very important one at that. He's one who left a really long legacy for anyone who followed him in that position, and also for just music educators in town in general. I mean, it's staggering to consider the number of lives that he touched and how many people of a certain generation still come up to me and say, oh, you know, I used to be in the orchestra when Julius was there, you know, and that's all they have to say to sort of impart that statement with great meaning. You know, in recognition, I think, of that legacy, his family started this competition for young musicians in his honor, the Stolberg Competition. I think it's one of the most exciting days of music in Kalamazoo. It happens every May, and it's just staggering the level of competition that happens now. I mean, we just heard a little ad from Performance Today about a 16-year-old who, you know, is this brilliant pianist and violinist. And right now, I think we've reached a point in human evolution or something like that where where the ability to play these instruments just you know, if people are willing to commit to them, it's just there's so many great players out there. So it really is stunning to see this competition, to see these young musicians who already perform really as fully fledged artists. There's really no part of it anymore where you think, oh well, isn't that good for a 16-year-old? You know, I mean that equivocation, that qualification is just no longer necessary. These are fully fledged artists.
They're ready to be hired to perform in front of adult orchestras and, you know,
absolutely,
5 days a week.
Absolutely. And yeah, which is why it's always such a thrill for us to get the bronze medal winner to perform with the Junior Symphony. Here is someone who is of the same age as many of our students, you know, a colleague in a lot of senses, but just someone who's playing at this sort of shockingly advanced level. And in the event, the bronze medal winner this year is Carissa Chu. And she performed the Sibelius Concerto at the competition last year, and that is indeed what she will be performing with the Junior Symphony coming up this Sunday.
One movement or the full concerto?
You know, when I first came to the Junior Symphony, these winners were still only doing one movement, and I thought, you know, considering the level where these folks play, as I was just commenting, it just doesn't seem right not to enjoy the full concerto. I mean, not only can they, do we know that they can do it, you know, it just seems like if they're going to come and work with us, we want to most fully take advantage of their presence. So since I've been at the orchestra, we've been doing the entire concerto.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably worth noting that even with her accomplishments, it's still rare for a person at this stage in her career to be able to perform with a full orchestra. So this is an opportunity that she will be gaining some experience from, a lot of great learning opportunity here, and a way to parlay it into her own resume as well.
I hope so, yeah. And I think there's also the quality that she is a peer inspiring other peers, which is a really nice part of it. But you're right. I mean, any opportunity to perform a piece that's especially this complicated, like the Sibelius, with orchestra is a chance for someone to learn, because no matter what that situation is, you know, you've still got a lot of musicians on stage, a lot of moving parts, and trying to figure out how a piece of this subtlety and nuance clicks together somehow is something that all of us learn from, myself included, every time.
I look forward to hearing more about how such an, I'm sorry to use an overused word, but an organic piece actually comes together to make it sound like it's fully natural and as it should be. But Sibelius has many techniques that are, for musicians, are challenging, but for us, sounds yes. so right.
So natural. Yes, yeah. Exactly. He's got such a distinctive voice. That's often the mark of great genius, I think, you know, no matter how unusual the language is, somehow it seems inevitable in the hands of someone who knows how to wield it so well.
You really focused on what seemed to me the pure, like coming from this romantic age, Schubert and Schumann, this is a kind of a deep dive mm-hmm. for the kids.
Yeah, exactly. This is the serious program of our year. That's not to say that the other ones aren't really serious too, but I would say that on the first program of the year, we had a bunch of shorter works, and some of them were quite flashy, things like the Candide Overture from Bernstein, which I deeply love, but is a very kind of razzle-dazzle sort of piece, you know? And then in the spring, we'll do, among other things, Scheherazade and Rhapsody in Blue. They're amazing pieces as well. Also just, you know, bright lights, you know, and lots of excitement. This has more than plenty of excitement, of course, but it's of a more inward-looking, I think, more profound sort of bent. Even the Sibelius Concerto, I would argue, I mean, concertos are naturally extroverted by virtue of the fact that they're sort of showing off the virtuosity of a single instrument, but as concertos go, Sibelius always has this dark hue to his writing, and there's always a kind of inward dialogue that's going on. So yes, it is a very much inward kind of program full of rather profound and, I dare say, even spiritual kind of musical insights. And I think that also ties with the larger program, what's really unifying these works. Because, of course, as I was just saying, the one thing that I began this program knowing that we would do was the Sibelius Concerto. And I thought about the Sibelius Concerto and how it came to be. And it was really, I suppose I'll talk about it a little bit more later, but it was really sort of an episode in Sibelius's life where he had a certain desire for a certain idea of how his life was going to go, and it didn't work out. And then as that sort of shifted directions, he began composing more and more. And many people think that the Violin Concerto was born of this sort of shifted path. And then I thought of some other composers who, in a similar vein, were denied a chance at what they might hope for themselves in life, and how that adversity played into their composing. It can be, of course, a little bit dangerous to always link music to the biography of a composer. Sometimes that's really insightful, sometimes it's less so. But I think in these cases, there's something to be said for the fact that all these composers were facing very difficult personal circumstances, and yet somehow under, even arguably from those difficult personal circumstances, they managed to parlay it into this great art. So we began the program with the music of Schumann. And Robert Schumann had plenty of challenges in his life, not least of which, but one that did work out successfully eventually, was that he fell deeply in love with this great young piano virtuoso, Clara Wieck, whom he immediately wanted to be his wife, and Clara's father really did not like the idea and really worked pretty strenuously against it. And it wasn't until she became of age, that she was a legal adult, that she could make her own decision, that they finally were able to get married. And that part worked out. But what didn't work out, of course, was that Schumann suffered a lot of personal illness throughout his life, specifically mental illness, something that he struggled with a great deal. And it kind of came and went. Some people sort of course, the language of diagnosis in the 19th century is very different than our modern language, but a lot of people look back on it and think this sounds very much like a sort of manic depressive cycle. And indeed, through a lot of Schumann's career, he would fall into these deep depressions, but then have these periods of incredible productivity, and also very frequently obsessively focused on one kind of genre. For example, people talk about the Year of Song, where he just, almost to the exclusion of everything else, composed songs, you know? And the Manfred Overture comes relatively late in his life, which was not a long life. He, unfortunately, the mental illness got the better of him in the end, and he committed suicide at the age of 46 after spending 2 years in a mental institution. But a few years before that already, he was at a point where he was starting to hear voices in his head. And it was during this time that he wrote the Manfred Overture. And in an interesting way, the story of Manfred, I think, is one that we can understand how it might have appealed to Schumann. It's a very unconventional, it's a sort of romantic anti-hero. It's sort of that first example of what has become, I think, for many of us, a Hollywood trope, that notion of the character who doesn't play by anybody's rules but his own, you know, that guy. that was Manfred in a lot of ways. He has some blemish in his past, and he feels guilty about his love for this other character. All of that is left unnamed in the book. It's just something, you know, something in his past that is clearly a great burden for him. So again, that sense of a burden that you're carrying, and I can imagine how Schumann would have responded to that. And he tries, Manfred, to summon spirits to help him forget, and that doesn't quite work. And then in the end, he's sort of encouraged to repent his previous sins so that he can live a clean life and go on to a better afterlife. But he refuses. He says, "It 'tis not so difficult to die," and just carries the burden with him, yeah, onward into past death. It's a fascinating story. It's one that captivated a lot of Europe. Tchaikovsky also wrote a symphony on this subject, and I think it produced, or for Schumann, it helped inspire, I would argue, some of his most successful music.
Really? Just, is it a book we're talking about or a play?
It's sort of in between a poem and a play. It's technically a play, but Lord Byron, who wrote it, sort of thought it unstageable. So he fully admitted that he, you know, even though it was written sort of in this way with a play in mind, that he didn't, it wasn't practical to stage, and therefore he imagined people only reading it. It captivated certainly Schumann's imagination, and he wrote incidental music for it, even though, again, it wasn't really supposed to be staged. And the overture, which is what we're performing, is, I think, one of his, maybe the strongest work, in my opinion, for orchestra, particularly from Schumann. It's just a brilliant encapsulation of a lot of these themes that I was just describing in the poem/play itself. Part of what's so brilliant about it is that Schumann writes in these very unusual keys, these difficult keys, but then the key that the music is actually in doesn't match the printed key signature. So it's very interesting. It's like Manfred himself. He's in this liminal space, sort of floating between worlds, right? Never quite sure, never quite certain of what his path is meant to be. And there are several themes. There's this initial very brusque gesture, which I imagine perhaps could allude to that past, that sullied past. And then this very sort of tragic yearning theme, which makes sense. And then there's this theme, I would argue, of steely defiance, and that's sort of the main theme. It's also quite amazing how he ends the overture. We think of overtures as being sort of curtain raisers, something that should be rousing at the end. And it seems as if Schumann is driving us towards that. And at the last minute, it just sort of runs out of steam. It just sort of slows down until it arrives back at that theme of yearning that we hear at the beginning, which again is an appropriate point for Manfred, who ends as he begins in a way, with that burden still with him, not able to escape, but not choosing not to escape it, but rather to embrace it in a way.
Wow. You've conjured up an amazing image here, and I can't wait to hear the music. Shall we take a break and listen to the Manfred Overture by Robert Schumann? The concert is Sunday at 4 o'clock at Chenery Auditorium, the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, beginning with this work by Robert Schumann. My guest is Andrew Kohler, and we'll be back to talk about the rest of the program soon. That's music of Schumann, the Manfred Overture, and we're listening with conductor Andrew Kohler. This is the work that opens the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra program on Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chenry Auditorium. So where are we now in this program?
Well, after surveying this music of Schumann, who wrote it during a particularly intense bout of mental illness where he was hearing voices in his head, he was just years away from being asking, actually, to be placed in a mental hospital, we go to the music of Schubert, who interestingly has another connection with Schumann in the sense that Schumann, who lived later than Schubert, was, you know, lived at a time when Romantic music was trying to figure out, was there any place for the symphony anymore, for these old classical forms, the forms that Haydn and Mozart would have used and loved, or did Romantic music require different forms, things like more personal ones, things that were maybe more tied to literature or other extra musical sources? And Schumann, who was a very influential writer as well and loved reading, as we can see by his inspiration from Manfred here, was kind of on the fence about it for a lot of his life. He thought, on the one hand, earlier in his life, he leaned towards wanting to write works that were programmatic, that is to say, that had extra musical associations, often literary ones. But late in his life, he came across Schubert's music, Schubert's late music, and a piece like the Ninth Symphony, for example. And that was something that convinced Schumann, wait, no, it is possible to use the old forms, the symphonies, the abstract forms, the ones that don't necessarily have a stated meaning, but still imbue them with the romantic spirit and a kind of personal narrative. And I think no less than the Ninth Symphony, the Eighth Symphony, the Unfinished, the famous Unfinished by Schubert, is a perfect example of that. Schubert, like Schumann, had a difficult hand dealt to him in life. He died at the age of 31, if you can imagine that. I mean, we think of Mozart as being the great genius whose life was cut short, but even he had 5 more years than that. And perhaps even more painfully, Schubert knew that he was going to die by the time he was about 26 or so, because he found out he was diagnosed with syphilis. So he knew at that point that that was a kind of death sentence that he had already. And given that difficult news, that incredible burden, it still amazes me every time I think about it. He decided to take his music in a totally different direction near the end of his life. So if you listen to a lot of earlier Schubert, it's very much in that classical vein. You have to think that he's living basically contemporaneously with Beethoven at this point, but is much younger than Beethoven. Very much the style of Vienna is still in that sort of classical mold. So imagine the music of Mozart or Haydn. And that's really how Schubert, who was a Vienna choir boy and properly trained in music, wrote almost all of his music. Meanwhile, Beethoven is starting at this point. He's gone deaf. He's starting to do some strange experiments. He's getting into his late phase, and he's doing all kinds of deeply personal music that is being met with, frankly, a lot of bewilderment by the Viennese public. They still think Beethoven's a great genius, but they think, well, I'm not really sure what to make of it. He seems like he's gone off his rocker a little bit here. And just to imagine that context, that here is a young Schubert, only 20-something, finds out he has really a very limited amount of time left on this earth. And then for him to say, to know of the kinds of experiments of Beethoven, and to head more in that very personal, what would eventually be called romantic direction near the end of his life, I think is an extraordinarily bold choice. He had, in a way, the luxury of not being performed very often in his lifetime. So he really didn't know. I mean, he could experiment. He could feel free to experiment because he just didn't think that anyone was going to be doing this stuff anyway.
He was not well known, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But still, I, you know, that he would invest in this music, that he heard something in those experiments of Beethoven and said, maybe I can find a way to put that into my own voice, that I can project this deeply personal mode of expression in my own music. And that you would take that risk at the end of your life, knowing that you have limited time left, that you would really shift gears and go in a different artistic direction, I think is extraordinary. And the Eighth Symphony is one of those, that turning point, at least in the symphonic series that he produced, is that very turning point where all of a sudden music that had been pleasant and beautifully structured and very much in that classical vein suddenly turns raging and despairing and full of this intense personal emotion. You know, and then the other interesting question, of course, is why is it unfinished, right? We don't really have the answer to
that. I was hoping you would have that today.
Well, no one really knows what the answer to that is. You know, there are plenty of ideas. It was a manuscript that was almost lost. You know, it could have just been that he wasn't sure how to continue on in this new direction at first. It could be that, yeah, maybe there are two other movements and we just were able to find them. That's certainly a possibility.
Mm-hmm. And composers don't finish everything they start.
Well, that's the other thing, of course. I mean, you've got limited time and maybe you go in another direction. In the event, though, these two movements are such perfect jewels, I think, from Schubert. And they're so emblematic. I mean, again, I don't wish to suggest by my talking about him in the context of Beethoven that he was by any means merely imitating Beethoven. Far from it. He was only taking that idea of very personal expression because it's very much in Schubert's own language. Beethoven really was not necessarily a great tunesmith. He was very much more, I'm going to take a motive and I will extract everything possible from it. On the other hand, Schubert was one of the great melodists. And the Unfinished Symphony, this eighth as it's usually numbered, even though that's not quite accurate, is full of those melodies. But it's also full of darkness, of pathos, of great rage. I think we should listen to a little bit of the first movement just because, you know, that's such, in many ways, familiar music, but maybe listening to it in this context, right, of someone who's made a radical departure in his artistic language and someone who is finding a more personal means of expression and who knows already that he is fated to die young, maybe puts it in a new context.
You can join Andrew Kohler and the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra in concert Sunday at 4 o'clock. Here's the beginning of the Schubert Unfinished Symphony. Well, that's all you're getting this morning on WMUK. This is a selection from the Unfinished Symphony, and if you tuned in during the music, the full symphony is on the program this Sunday at Chenery Auditorium, Andrew Kohler conducting the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra. And I wanted to ask what, once in a while I ask you, how did the kids respond to the music that you've programmed? And I know everything is so new for them. These are great, great works.
They are. They're great works. And I think, as I was saying earlier, they're rather profound works. So they're a little less flashy and a little bit more
the themes
inward.
We're talking about are grown-up themes, you know, struggling with the burden of living and with our own problems and things like that. Yeah.
I think the Schubert, I mean, especially because of its tunefulness, was something that the students responded to pretty immediately. And I think many of them already knew it because it is such a famous piece. I think the Sibelius has proved, well, the Sibelius just offers a different sort of set of challenges because we get very little time with the soloist. And that's such an important line. So we're having to sort of spend all our time preparing in this very abstract mode where we're missing the most important single musical line almost the entire rehearsal process and just trying to get everything else ready. And not just ready, but also ready in a way that prepares us to be flexible for whatever might come. Carissa will join us for a dress rehearsal tonight, but that'll be our first time and only time, really, that we get to put it together. So we really have to be ready to make it work at a moment's notice. I think the Manfred was maybe the piece that was the most difficult to understand, the most elusive. But I think they're playing everything really beautifully. And I think the lovely thing is that musical gesture, I think, can be inspired to work maybe perhaps more profoundly if you really understand or have lived the circumstances that you imagine are being portrayed in there, but also without it in a way. I mean, we tap into, I think, a communal, universal well of human feeling. We can all find ways to relate to these sorts of experiences. I mean, that's really the fundamental part of what art is. And I think that it gives us this wonderful opportunity to hear music one way when we're teenagers, perhaps, you know, experience it one way and then hear it again differently in 10 years' time or 20 or 50 years' time.
The works do imprint on a young person's brain and feelings. And music has that incredible quality to make time disappear when you're hearing it decades later. And suddenly you're back in the past again and hearing the piece. And
I was a high school student at the high school part of Tanglewood, and that was the first time that I performed Brahms' Second Symphony, and we would rehearse in this barn basically in Western Massachusetts, which was of course made out of wood and had a very distinctive kind of wooden smell, you know. And I can still smell what that barn smells like when I hear the first notes of Brahms 2. I can remember it so clearly in ways that I can't say that I remember other details of that time in my life. It's an incredible link to memory. And I think not least of which, because we need to spend so long learning these works, relatively speaking. Of course, we as professional musicians get to a point where we say, well, got to be able to do it, you know, practice it in a couple rehearsals and then we're ready to go. That's a useful skill, but also it means that repertoire does not stay with us as long as this does, where we have to take months and months to prepare it, to get it to a point where we can perform it. And those things, I think, get kind of embedded into our consciousness in a much more profound way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. I've had composers on the program and snuck in a little piece that they wrote, and they'll be like, that's nice. I wrote that. Yeah. It's later in life, things do get churning.
Yes. Right? Yes, indeed.
So, these are special pieces you've programmed for Sunday, and we are now ready to talk about a little bit more about the Sibelius in the last 9 minutes of this hour. Hope to play a few minutes of one of the movements a bit later.
Yeah. You know, the Sibelius Concerto, I alluded earlier, was the starting point of this whole dreams deferred, art born of adversity program. In the case of Sibelius, it's a little, perhaps a little less tragic, a little more prosaic what happened, but it's a simple thing. Sibelius really imagined himself a violin virtuoso. He thought that's what his life was going to be. And he went to Vienna and was able to study there for a little while and then auditioned for the Vienna Philharmonic and was roundly rejected. He was pretty upset about this. But it's interesting, even at the age of 50, he would sometimes still write in his diary things like, dreamt that I was 12 again and a violin virtuoso on stage. And this is a perfect example of how something that just didn't go Sibelius's way in a more broad-reaching sense did go the way for, you know, was a lucky break for the rest of us, because he, of course, poured those energies instead into composition and became just an extraordinary voice in that regard. His violin concerto is the only concerto that he wrote, and some violinists would argue that maybe the violin part is so difficult as retribution for not having made it along this career path that he once dreamed he would. But in a lot of ways, it is just a sumptuously beautiful work. And as with all great concertos, it is, of course, an amazingly virtuosic vehicle for the violin or for the solo instrument. But that's not really what drives it. In other words, it's not merely the hope of showing off, but it's a beautiful and deeply expressive and a profoundly logical musical statement. I mean, everything in Sibelius, as you mentioned earlier, is so organic. Part of what makes it seem so organic is that, you know, his themes seem composed of little bits, almost mosaic-like, you know, that keep coming around, much like Beethoven did before him, but sometimes in a different form. He often gives us not the full theme and then little snippets, but rather little snippets that somehow eventually cohere. The violin concerto is, it only occurred to me this time, as many, I've you know, played the piece and conducted it several times already, but it only just occurred to me this last time that the very opening of the concerto, which I hope we'll have time to listen to now, sounds very much as if it's in a dream itself, which seems so appropriate given those journal entries of Sibelius. And of course, I hasten to add that the Stolberg Bronze Medalist, Carissa Chu, will be our soloist. She's right now a student at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, one of the most competitive schools of music in the country, and is just an extraordinary player. And we're so excited to have her here and partner, as always, with the Stolberg competition.
This concert is Sunday at 4 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium. The KJSO has a website, kjso.org, for more details there. Tickets will be available at the door. And online. Terrific. Yes. I think we'll leave it here so we can hear a little more of the music. So all I have to do is thank you very much, Andrew Kohler, for coming in to talk about this music, and good luck on the concert Sunday.
Thank you so much, Kara.